the gift of the healer that he shares, I think, with those of us who do psychoanalytic work, however reluctantly among some of our colleagues, is that we are given an idea of the human mind as being always in a process of mediating the real world and the drives of sex and aggression, which, if not moderated, can lead to terrible things. That's where we're in there. And that's what our training helps us to do.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Martha Bragan. Dr. Bragan is a psychoanalyst and a social worker, and is a jointly appointed professor at the Silberman School of Social Work at Hunter College in the PhD program in social welfare at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Our conversation today is around the work she has done in wartime situations. We discuss her work in El Salvador and Angola, but it's been much broader than that. She has really aided those most desperately in need in the most troublesome parts of the world. And in her work in Angola, there's a clinical case we discuss that she's written up. A child soldier named Pedrito, and the traumas he went through and the traditional healings that he underwent in the cultural context. And there's a concept that we get to at the very end called Ubuntu, U-B-U-N-T-U. And it's an important concept to understand the conditions under which she, the healers, and the patients are functioning under. And she shared with me a definition of it. And she says it's a collection of values and practices that Bantu peoples of Africa view as making people authentic human beings. And while the nuances vary, they all point to one thing. An authentic individual human being is part of a larger and more significant relational, communal, societal, environmental, and spiritual world. And it is through that lens that we try to understand the approach of the traditional healers and how it dovetails with our own thinking about a dynamic approach to the mind. Dr. Bragan has been working for literally decades studying the effects of violence on individuals, especially children. She's worked with United Nations agencies, governments, non-governmentals, and people's organizations, and especially on violence and families and communities. She has been leading many organizations, too many to mention at this point, but I do want to make a note that she is a recipient of the IPA's Tyson Prize, as well as the very prestigious Hyman Prize for published work on traumatized children and adults. And she's won that twice, in 2011 and 2021. And she's written, again, very widely, and she's in private practice in New York City. And I learned a great deal in this conversation and in getting familiar with her work, and I hope you find it meaningful as well. Martha, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you here. Martha, in my conversations with many of our colleagues who are doing work that we've sort of colloquially called off-the-couch work, applied analysis, what we've learned is that they take their analytic sensibility and they bring it to settings that are outside the consulting room. Could be hospitals, refugee centers, political negotiations, to boardrooms, to classrooms. And you've certainly done that kind of work, and we're going to hear about it. But you've done something quite unique, and that is you've immersed yourself in the work of traditional healers and sort of reverse engineered it. That is, that you've tried to learn about what the dynamic underpinnings of that, to translate their way of thinking and their interventions to language that we understand and that reflect our basis of healing. And we're going to talk about that in a fascinating case that you wrote up some time ago on a child soldier named Pedrito. And more recently, your work has also focused on the moral third, Jessica Benjamin's concept, that you think is also valuable in integrating people who have been overexposed to violence in their lives. And we're going to get to that as well. But to make sense of this, to give it a context, let's begin with your sharing your journey. You have worked clinically, you have you're deeply associated with your social work background, and you have brought that to areas of stunning turmoil and violence in El Salvador, Angola, Afghanistan. Give us a feel for you and this work. Tell us about what you were doing in El Salvador, and then we'll get to your work in Angola.
Thank you for the lovely introduction, Harvey. I appreciate it. So I came to El Salvador in the 80s, initially as a result of my involvement in the social work community. Just briefly, like many, many social workers in the U.S., I was both trained as a student and then started my early work career in child guidance programs that were led by emigres from Germany and Europe, who had to flee either during or following the Holocaust. And they brought those sensibilities to the community. So the idea of community psychoanalysis was embedded from that tradition. And I found myself, after a few years working there, I had the real privilege of being asked to supervise a program, the original PINS diversion program, which diverted youth in New York, and it's still there, mandatory today, originally from age 16 downwards. To divert them from the family court process and engage with them and their families to try to figure out what was going on that brought them to family court and then refer them for treatment.
So in place of legal proceedings, they would have emotional work with the family?
They would meet with our team, with the PINS diversion team, the diversion team, have 6 weeks. And I can send this material to you if you're interested, but we have, because we still teach it, we have 6 weeks of an assessment with the family, the community, and the child to figure out what was going on that led to the incident that brought them to court. And then they were sent to a a tailored program for continuing treatment that was mandatory for a minimum of 18 months.
I see. Uh-huh. And that set the stage for your traveling.
So that's where I was. Uh-huh. And at the same time, I'm a good NAS, National Association of Social Workers member. And so we had a committee at that time in New York in the 80s looking at human rights abuses of social workers around the world. And it was under that program that I was first sent to on a delegation to El Salvador to look at the plight of Marta Elena Rodriguez, who was a social worker in El Salvador who was imprisoned. And NASW, most cases they were able to do nothing. In this case, they were actually able to help to get her out of prison. I got to meet her. We sat down, talked about each other's work. And her response to me was, you know, you think you've got troubles. You're telling me that these kids' problems were the way they were affected by violence and separation from families and things that happened before they went into refugee status. I'm telling you that the kids in this country are so overexposed to violence that if this war doesn't stop soon, it won't matter who wins because of the way these kids are being hurt. And her idea, which was just beginning then, was to work with Father Martin Barrault, who was a supervisor at the university there in psychology, to develop a program that could be run in the communities by Teenagers for Younger Kids and women in the Women's Association with only lay training. And so that's how that involvement started. Subsequently, I was going to go down and visit when Father Martin Barrault was murdered. And because of that murder, they were looking for somebody to supervise periodically and asked for me to do that. And a women's organization called Madre supported my work periodically, going back and forth, where I did something that wasn't so much supervision, but really what I call accompaniment.
Yeah, say what it is. But let me just ask you something, because I think anyone listening to what you just said would have the same reaction I did. So the guy who was running this program was murdered. So they then
asked, supervisor.
Yes.
Marta Elena was running. He was doing the supervision from his post at the university.
And then they asked you to take over his position? Do I get that right?
They asked me if I would come and help with supervision because they knew they needed an outside supervisor.
Did it give you pause that he had been murdered in that very role?
It gave me great pause that he'd been murdered. It gave me great pause that's why Madre was formed. Madre was a women's organization that sought to learn about community organization from our colleagues in struggle around the world. And at the same time, to pay back with whatever skills we happen to have. Okay. So I was a social work supervisor. That was a skill. People thought they could use it. Madre was able to pay for my airfare. I was able to come during vacations from work, especially when my kids were able to be in camp or with their dad.
Okay. So, You mentioned to me that either you or they, help me with this, reconceptualize these children as being not violent children, but children who are overwhelmed by violence. A very important distinction.
Asking me this way is very embarrassing because I'm going to feel terrible, but I have to say, this is what they should put on my tombstone. This was me. I did it in a big conference in New York City in 1992, where we said, you know, there was all this talk in the 80s about violent kids. Remember that? Sure. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that.
Yeah,
talking
indeed.
About youth violence and the super predators and all that stuff. So since we were interviewing so many kids and their families, we were really in a position to flip that script and say, actually, these aren't violent children. These are children affected by violence.
Let me just issue a question on that, because I think it's a crucial perspective. But would it be more accurate to say, at least conceptually, I don't know how you would carry it out clinically, but it's important to begin by seeing them as children impacted by violence. At a certain point in this hypothetical treatment, they would have to take responsibility for their own violence and unpack where that lives within them. Yes? So it's sort of like a two-step process that you introduced the first step of?
See, the two-step is problematic to me as somebody who is a specialist in children's well-being and development and protection.
Okay.
So what kids do when they're affected by violence, of course, has to be addressed. Nobody's saying that it doesn't.
Sure.
But, and some, many of them had not actually committed the kinds of acts of violence that people might imagine. They may have been guilty of breaking things in the home, getting in fights in the street.
Right.
You know, these kids weren't murderers.
Got it. But they were exposed to murder.
They were kids. Now, I'm not talking about the child soldiers. I'm talking about the New York City.
No, I know. Yes, yes. But they were exposed to murder.
These are kids who may have been handed a gun, who may have been, they've been exposed to some really scary things. They were not child murderers. They were children who'd been in fights, as kids had been so many years in New York City, as kids are.
Yes.
They were kids who were fighting in their household, being ungovernable, putting themselves and others in danger. But we're talking about primarily, the question is, what's the chicken and what's the egg? Is the chicken, is, you know, these kids, there was some idea that because their parents may or may not have done crack or done some other substance, that they were so damaged that they had no attachments, or that because they've been separated from parents in early years, this could be a whole podcast in itself.
I'm sure.
What happens to kids' attachments?
Yeah.
And how, and I published on that, and that's not on the list I gave you.
Okay.
But it's really thinking about the attachments when, you know, who are these kids' attachments? But we did not find kids that didn't have attachments. We found, and that's why I asked you to listen to that Wycliffe John song.
Sure, sure,
I did. From 1989, I think it was, when it was popular. That these are kids who are loving, who are seeking love, who are caring, and who are deeply hurt and so affected by being exposed to terrible, terrible violence that nobody should see. And that at the same time, you know, these are complicated concepts, and we didn't get into this in our earlier conversation.
Right.
These are really complicated child development concepts, and that's been my lifelong work, thinking about these child development concepts, looking at Klein, working with Peter Fonagy, looking at working with kids in schools, getting some results by drawing on their need for love and attachment and their capacity for love and attachment, and helping them with their terrible sense of guilt and of complicity, and at the same time, their sense of being abandoned by a moral world. So these things are all of a piece when we want to talk about child development. And that's why, and that's who I am at core. I was trained to work by the Jewish Board of Family and Children's Services to work with children's development and to see where there's been a glitch, to help programs, whether they're international programs, whether they're local programs, whether they're schools, whether they're in my office, to help see that point where that, where the violence impeded or affected that development, and help them get on the developmental trail. And usually what we have to do is allow reparation so that they can tolerate what you're talking about, which is right, the acknowledgement of violence that's actually been committed and violence that they've fantasized. And for the kids, they're so on a continuum that it's hard to sort of.
We're going to talk a bit about reparation because that's key to your work, not just in New York, but around the world. But your work in accompanying these children in El Salvador. Can you give us a feel for what that was like?
So I'm not accompanying the children. Who I'm accompanying are my fellow caregivers.
I see.
And but they're also people who are living in tremendous, tremendous situations of danger and violence. People are getting murdered in gruesome ways every day. I was also working, as we mentioned, through Madre with similar programs in Guatemala, where there was a genocide going on at that time, officially recognized by the U.S., and through the support of ELAS, the what's it called? The Inter-American, Instituto Latinoamericano for Salud Mental from Chile, with the colleagues who were doing similar work in the southern, in Angola and Mozambique. And of course, this was the time of the dirty war in Argentina and the wars in Chile and Uruguay. So we had many psychoanalytic colleagues thinking about this. And the question is, are we bearing witness? And I felt like I wasn't really bearing witness. Bearing witness, I'm sitting there and I'm witnessing them. Right. But what I'm rather doing is I'm accompanying them on their journey. They're doing it. But when you're under that kind of pressure, as we know, it's very hard to think. And without thinking, you can't be helpful. So when somebody shows up from the outside, they may not be able to do supervision because they may not really understand the context. What they may be able to do is help local people to have somebody to say, let us tell you about it. Let us tell you our experience. And in the process of my ignorance and my errors, to be able to clarify for me what it was they were trying to do and how they would do it. And that went with the colleagues. There's a paper on the list that's my most well-known, I think, one of the most well-known, Knowing Terrible Things, where I talk about it, one of the Salvadorans and my relationship with her in treatment. But there was a whole process where people could say, yes, you get this. No, you don't get that. Let me explain. Let me tell you. And help them to feel recognized, seen, and not alone. So I thought about that in a beyond sense in those days, to have some kind of a link.
We could spend all our time on your work in El Salvador, of course, but then you get to Angola. Tell us about the situation there, and then we'll talk about this young man, Pedrito.
So, in Angola, one of the things that happened with the fall of the Soviet Union, the Cold War ended, and in so many countries around the world, including Central America, the fighting stopped because one side was supported, because these were proxy wars.
Right.
And the investigations into what had happened started. But that did not happen in Angola. Some say it's because Angola is so rich. Carlinda Monteiro, my psychologist friend and colleague, always said, our wealth is our poverty. But it was also because the U.S. didn't have a guy in Angolan society who actually had an interest in fighting the government. So they finally found somebody, a bit of an outcast, believed to be mentally ill, and supported him along with the South Africans with huge, you know, as they did later and as they were doing actually in Afghanistan, but that's another story for another day.
Yeah,
they
right.
flooded Angola with weapons of mass destruction, with tanks, with the latest armaments. So this guy named Joseph Savimbi decides to fight on, and he can't get Angolans to join him. He doesn't have volunteers. And that was really how the whole recruitment of child soldiers – in Africa began. It was with the support of unsupportable groups who then had to literally go into villages and kidnap kids to fight in their armies that my tax dollars were paying for.
Right. Now, you sharpen our focus on using one particular boy who had a horrendous background to then become a child soldier. Can you give us a snapshot of who he was when he was stolen away, in a sense, by UNITA and turned into a child soldier? What his background was, his mother, his father?
This was, you know, Carlinda thought that this would be a good team to have some very close accompaniment because they were working in a place out, a little outside, a little bit in the hinterlands where things were very, very difficult. So the situation then was that the war was dragging on outside of the capital cities. The cities would be safer. You could bring people in for treatment like this, but the countryside was unsafe. Savimbi had once again, he was supposed to have made a peace deal. He was supposed to have surrendered. He didn't do it. And so there were constant raids continuing to go on. Kids were being stolen and things were very difficult for the entire clinical team run by Child Fund Angola in cooperation with UNICEF.
And Pedrito had a terrible past. His father died when he was
under two. So he was growing up outside of a port city that was at one time well known, very beautiful. And but his father is fighting in this war that was originally the War of Liberation, but then became the war against UNITA when the country got its independence. His father was, fighting for the country. His mom was running a little fruit stand in the local market. That's how she supported herself and the kids. And she had two children. And she would, you know, and she was taking the kids every day. And the government was providing a kind of a daycare center as soon as kids turned two. They could go to the center and they'd get nutritious meals and they'd sing songs and mom would get a break. And at some point, she gets sick.
Now, just to be clear, his father died when he was under two, you write.
Yeah.
And then his sister left and he was caring for his mother.
So what happened is when his mom got sick, some relatives came to collect the sister, and he really threw a tantrum. He didn't want to leave his mother initially. So he was left there, and there was a Cuban encampment of soldiers who were fighting in this proxy war.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they were doing a lot of work with kids as part of their international propaganda. We're the good guys. So they sent a specific soldier whose idea was to check on the family and to begin to protect them. And he was bringing food and this and that and telling the kid, you know, you're going to have to come and stay with me because mom is sick. So that went on for, we don't know, a few months. And then he was brought, mom dies. The Cubans arranged a burial and he goes to their orphan asylum on the camp.
And you paint this picture of this Cuban soldier, perhaps seen through Pedrito's eyes, I don't know, but as a very loving, attentive, and present, consistently present man in his life. Again, his father was killed. He was otherwise just had his sister and his mother. And this Cuban soldier was vitally important to him. And he too, along with the other Cuban soldiers you recount, were also murdered.
So, right. So he stays there and he's got some, and they're having treatment for the kids.
Right.
And the thing that becomes important to him later is the kids are constantly being caught playing very violent games where they're enacting things that are going on.
Right.
And the very Western trained Cuban mind doctor is saying, probably a PhD in psychology, is saying, no, we have to play the healthy games. Here are the healthy games. Play the healthy games. And the kids are, you know, are caught being naughty and they have to play the healthy games, but there is a lot of drawing and teaching and singing and, you know, you're part of a family. And all of a sudden, these guys, the camp is raided, the Cubans are all murdered, and the kids are marched off into this terrible fate. Now, this is after about 4 years.
Just to give a brief overview, you describe in your paper that he likely, because not all of it is documented, but he likely participated in horrendous violent acts under the instigation, if not enforcement, of the adult soldiers. But he was, and we heard about this in the States, about the violence that these kids were both subjected to and did to others.
So very clearly in his case, this is what was documented. What was documented was that these kids were troublesome. They really weren't prepared to kill anybody. They were trying to resist in the beginning, and they were made very sick by the punishments. And that part is documented. But at some point, by his own confession, and what I read through my notes and also the published paper, nobody actually knew how much he actually did. You know, journalists would come and ask these kids, how many people did you kill? Do you know? Do you not know? Kids would freak out. And the feeling was that nobody really knows how much he actually did, how much he thought he did, and where the line was drawn. The kids were kept up all night dancing. They were given drugs. So nobody really knows how much he did, how much he imagined he did. The point was that he certainly did something, and that it was all conflated in his minds with the games. They couldn't tell the difference. And I found that over and over with kids in various situations, that where there have been these childhood games, and Melanie Klein writes about that, that, you know, criminal behavior in normal children, that there is something about kids' need for reparation and their violent fantasies that exists probably in all humans. And when you force kids to enact something that should have been nicely repressed, or when you enact it in front of them, in both instances, you're tainting that process in a way that becomes unbearable. So we don't know how many people he killed, or whether he killed anybody, or whether he tortured anybody, or if so, how many people. And he didn't know, but he did something. We're sure that there were some acts of violence.
Let's jump to the treatment, because that's really what your paper focuses on, which is he was treated by two traditional healers. The first one, as you described it, took care of or addressed the war trauma, and the second one addressed the underlying character, we might say, about the war trauma. But just to put this in context, let me read just a brief sentence that you wrote about the culture in which he was living, his family was involved with, and the traditional healers work from. You write that the Bantu people view reality as existing simultaneously on two planes, one seen and one unseen. The seen comprises the external reality, while the unseen included the spirits of the ancestors. Now, we would all make a link to what we think of the two planes that we exist on using similar but different words. But tell us about his symptoms, and then I'm going to ask you to read a part of your paper that's in the section called Clinical Application of Psychoanalytic Theory. This is when he was having nightmares and headaches, and he had a stealing episode, and that was after the first episode, the first traditional healer, yeah?
The nightmares and headaches were the cause of the first treatment.
Okay.
And both treatments, they have both a psychopharmacologist type traditional healer who gives you some sedatives, see if you can get you calmed down. And then the traditional healer who does the symbolic work.
Lots of herbs and things, yeah?
Lots of herbs that are actually chemically not dissimilar from those that we use in common mm-hmm. tranquilizers and antidepressants and some antipsychotics. So they're trying to give them some of that. They give all these kids this traditional healing, and it does do something for the nightmares and the headaches. And okay. the nightmares are interesting because Freud documents something about what they're about in Totem and Taboo. But he's having nightmares about having killed people, and right. it's unbearable to him, and it doesn't matter who they were. But then he's supposedly cured. He goes back to the sister's house. No more nightmares, or at least he doesn't confess to them. No more headaches. Doing better. And I think it's 2 weeks or 4 weeks later, something like that. Very soon thereafter, he goes and steals something. And the sister's like, I've had it. This guy's not staying in my house. And so the CCF team, which is following him as a former child soldier, comes in and says, let's give it a minute. Let's see what we can do.
And you have a section of your paper that you can read that'll familiarize the listener with.
So we're starting with he who kills heals.
Yes. Yes.
He who heals kills. Such is the nature of life. Because he's looking at the idea that even though he has already been treated in a way that shows that he can be cleansed of his violence, he is and given good thing give good things to the community, it is not all, it is not enough. So he buys and kills two animals, a chicken and a goat. He wraps the youngster in the blood of the animal that he has killed. Then he cooks the animal and lets the family feast on the meat. The young killer wrapped in the animal's blood and skin and getting warmth from them is publicly acknowledged as bloodied as bloodying at the same time that his healing becomes a source of food for the community. This symbolizes acceptance that a person who is killed may be one who brings good things as well, and that both of these capacities exist in all of us.
Now, the context for this is that, as you describe in a number of your papers, that they have a particular sense of the individual in relation to the community. The way you put it, you write, the self that exists for the purpose of social participation. The self that exists for the purpose of social participation. So, therefore, their notion of healing is not an individual sort. It's the individual in relation to the community. And you describe how these rituals, while some might attach the notion of primitive to it, it involves killing animals and blood and feeding people, in fact, speaks quite directly to the gestalt of the community. And you quote later, you write, there is no present without the past. The ancestors are always among us here. There is no future that does not embrace history. History of the family, of the village, of the future of us all. And that was a quote from Pedrito's traditional healer. Again, it sounds so similar to Lowell's notion about how turning ghosts into ancestors, and ancestors are always present in all of us. Can you say more about how you see the interface between these two healing methods, the traditional healer and the dynamic thinker?
What we're trying to do when we meet people in terrible distress, for instance, as you have, soldiers who've come back from war, and where the compact of childhood development, that this is a phase, it's a fantasy, it goes away, we grow up, we learn to follow the rules of the community and find our place in it. And instead, they can't do that because these things have been enacted. Things that are supposed to be fantasies, dreams, imagination, were enacted. They're in the position of poor Oedipus, right? Jocasta says to Oedipus, oh, don't worry about that dream. All men dream about sleeping with their mothers, mm-hmm. except Oedipus has actually done it, but he's not aware. And the other thing that we're thinking about that is dynamic when we see our patients, particularly those who've been exposed to a lot of violence, is that they don't have the privilege of getting over it. And if they did, it's been waked up because they've been forced to have these things not be in video games, not be in fantasies, but actually happen in front of them. On the other hand, the gift of the healer that he shares, I think, with those of us who do psychoanalytic work, however reluctantly among some of our colleagues, is that we are given an idea of the human mind as being always in a process of mediating the real world and the drives of sex and aggression, which, if not moderated, can lead to terrible things. That's where we're in there. And that's what our training helps us to do. So if we can go there with our training, and the traditional healers help us understand that, then we can join. Then it's not so separate. We're not just bearing witness and staring. You have had terrible things happen to you. And me, I'm the good guy. Instead, we can emotionally help them be accompanied in that space. And then we know that it's so terrible to think about your own violence that it's unbearable, because we do it ourselves and go, oh, I don't want to go there. Even if there's most people have something to be found. I don't think I'm the only one. But even if there's nothing to be found, we know that there's something to be found in wishes and dreams. And once we know how hard it is to go there, we understand Melanie Klein's concept of reparations. If we can connect to the world of kindness, of giving, of the mother's good breast, of that memory, it becomes tolerable. So whether it was CCF and the catechistas or the healers, they knew immediately that there had to be something put in place to help people to help repair and for these kids to be connected in some way to that goodness that they also have as part of the depressive position. So that's how I see us connected. We work symbolically in the same place. Our tools are different. And what I find, by the way, very interesting in 2023 as a teacher is we have all these young folks coming into our classrooms telling us we want to do more embodied work and we have to do things that are more physical. And sitting in the chair or the couch isn't enough. They want to know what you can do that's more physical and less airy-fairy. So I'm interested in the contemporary applications. Does that help? Does that answer your question?
Yes, very much. What you also write about is utilizing Beyond's notion of K, knowing, and L for love. And you describe how these traditional processes involving the community, because they often participate in them, helps the patient, the boy, feel known. And known by, in this case, a caring man. And then you say that the healer in his second treatment stayed with him for months.
Yeah.
And so it went from Beyond's K to Beyond's L, love. And it became a loving relationship, which also was a key healing one. Well, let me read a piece that you write that also illuminates the interface between the two. You say the youngster is told that war leaves unquiet the spirits of those harmed, and that neither he nor they will rest until he has made restitution for the disharmony that he has caused. He is told that the unquiet spirit lives within him as rageful beings because he has acted on the violence that should live only in dreams. This begins the process of making the unconscious conscious. You know, you mentioned briefly before about my own experience treating soldiers. What you were referring to is back in the late 70s, I was involved with treating Vietnam veterans. And frankly, looking back on the treatments we had then and the understandings we had then, I don't think it was as sophisticated as what you're describing the traditional healer's understanding is, because we were treating individuals, and it's not that there's nothing to treat there, but we weren't appreciating the social context. And what's so vital in this early work with this boy, and could have been early work with the Vietnam veterans, is a focus on the community and the importance of reparation and restitution and the community acknowledgement of the violence and acceptance of them and the violence. That wasn't happening back in the late 70s for Vietnam veterans. And that was unfortunate for all concerned. Let's talk about the moral third. And in doing that, you have an amazing vignette having to do with bars of soap that will bring Lady Macbeth to everybody's mind. Tell that story about the bars of soap.
Okay, so there were four little boys who I will call the four Mohammeds. I want us to move now from a very different war situation, which I don't have the time for me to go into, in West Africa, and the end of the last months of a violent conflict in Sierra Leone that was well known in the year 2000 and 2001. And at that time, there was something called there was a blue line. So the rebels were still active in one part, but the government and international forces had cleared part of the country and it was safe, and they were grabbing kids, and UNICEF was taking all these kids and demobilizing them, and they were placed in these centers where the community members, some of them social workers, some of them psychologists, were running programs for them while their parents were being sought. And they had the usual things you do for kids. They had school, they had group therapy, they had art, etc. And there's these four kids, and they are not coming in. They're not joining. And we're trying to get some kind of play going on, something going on with them. They were the youngest and we believed probably among the most damaged. So later we heard stories that were horrendous beyond anybody's belief. So these four little boys are there outside and we start to get to know them because of they look at us really scary and they say, "Nice watch." And I would go, "Like, I like it too. How are you today?" And after a while, they were looking forward to meeting us. Mm-hmm. When I get this call that they have run away, they are off walking to the capital city to protest their innocence because they've been accused of stealing soap for the purpose of selling it in the market. So my boss in this, Samuel Kavanda, he brings the kids back and we tell them it's okay. There's going to be a group meeting and they will be allowed to protest their innocence. And the story is that the kids get a bar of soap once a week. Soap was scarce. They got a bar once a week and they are asking for a new bar every other day. And the people who are working with them conclude, you see, these are dangerous kids. They're not only affected by violence, they're violent and they're up to no good. They're probably selling these soap and they're buying liquor or God knows what in the market. We want to put a stop to this. The boys protest their innocence. So Mr. Kavanda says, okay, Dr. Martha's going to be our moderator here. We're giving her a bar of soap. We're giving each of you boys a bar of soap. You all see the book. You're each getting one shower a day for the next week, and you're going to come back and show us your soap. And they have to call a meeting after 4 days because they're about to be out of soap. I come to my great embarrassment after thinking about this. I got a big fat chunk of soap in my hand.
So you didn't use up your soap. They did.
I didn't use up my soap. Right. They barely had a nub. And they said, and the littlest said, "Mr. Kamanda, we scrub and we scrub, but we have done terrible things, terrible things, and we cannot get ourselves clean again.
Yeah, it's a terrible
pour story. A libation for us so that we can rejoin the community. And Mr. Commander looks at me because I'm sent there by UNICEF and the World Bank and the people with the money. And I look at him and he said, is this a good thing? He says, yes. I said, okay, we're going to do it. And that's where the moral third come in. These boys who have been through so many terrible things have a connection in their mind. They are longing for a just and moral universe. And they're remembering that in the before times, there was a way, there was a thing that was done that could make people, that could acknowledge that violence. So it was a remarkable ceremony. I don't know how much I have time for you to tell
just,
you.
Just give a brief moment of it.
All right, a brief moment. It involves every level of the community, representatives of the government, the army, the traditional healing, the traditional leaders, the teachers, the police, and the owner of the land. Everybody has to get together. And the place has been cleaned. The place has been painted. And again, there is a ceremony involving some animals. And the important thing about the ceremony is that the community says, you need to be cleaned, but we also need to be cleaned because we as adults should have protected you. And we failed. Now, they failed because, you know, people were murdered, knives were held to their heads, the kids were...
But the kids' experience was that they weren't protected.
They, as adults, had a responsibility to protect, and in Sierra Leone, it's both the very land on which these crimes should not be committed, and the kids themselves. And then the healer comes in, and while he's smearing blood for all those who are, he comes over to me and he recognizes me as somebody who is also an implicated subject and who experiences herself as an implicated subject. And he gets it. What am I doing to hell in the middle of his country? And the implications of not only the slave trade so long ago, but also recent, you know, again, recent Cold War and post-Cold War involvement in arming groups of people who should never have been armed because they were able to do such harm. And it's clear that I understand my own privilege and I have some problem. So I get smeared with the blood for my implication as a subject, as part of the adult community that didn't protect these kids. The kids are also implicated. Again, there's a slaughtered goat. The goat is feeding everybody. Everybody eats. There's a festival. There's drums. There's a lot of symbolic action. And then treatment begins. It's not that this is the treatment, but treatment begins. And what I realized was that this represented what I had read about in Benjamin's Moral Third, and we all sort of thought, I think, in the psychoanalytic community, yeah, that's a little goody-two-shoes for violence specialists like me. Then I'm thinking, actually, no. There is in all of us, perhaps related to that moment with the good breast as part of the depressive position, there is a part of us that wants to be participants in a world that is not partisan, that is not harming, and that can be represented by a third space of treatment, which allows for the achievement of morality, but can only happen And that brought me back to my work in Brooklyn. This is what we could not do for our kids. We did so much for our kids in that program, and we do so much. But we never had, to this day, from the U.S. government, even in the case of the exonerated five, we never had a situation, even in the case of one of our presidential candidates being confronted by her having participated in this, have we had a saying, we should have protected the all of our children in this country, all of our children, from all of the violence of our past and our present. And we take responsibility. We are all implicated subjects. Not this Robin DiAngelo, I gotta feel guilty, I gotta feel bad. But we, all humans, all adults, we owe our children a space to grow up in which the rules of the world are honorable and they can trust it.
You know, it sounds like if there's truth there, people from different communities will see it. I say that given much of what you're saying. We are all looking at what it means to be overwhelmed by violence from the outside, from the inside. Even this model of the whole community coming together, as soon as I learned about it, I immediately thought, back in the 70s, there was something called network therapy. It was created by a psychiatrist, an analyst, a family therapist called Ross Speck. It was centered in Philadelphia, but it was very widely known. And he would do just what you described. He would bring together, he would have interventions, but it was 50, 70, 100 people, not just family members, but community members, shopkeepers, and they would all come together over a weekend and struggle with the energy of the social to intervene with someone who was otherwise not available. And the overlap between these two ways of thinking about the individual living in the community is, it's almost word for word. And it's so lovely, Martha, that you bring this to our attention again. The 1970s was a long time ago. And that you help us be aware for many individuals working with large groups and a social concept of what they will respond to and how reparation needs to take place, as you point out, in both directions. The patient needs to feel that he is repairing the community, and the community needs to feel that they are repairing the individual in all of our oversights and omissions. We could spend so much more time, Martha, on this work, and perhaps at some point we will. It's wonderful work. I'm so glad you're continuing to do it here in the States. As useful as your work overseas is, we don't want to lose this influence that you're bringing to us in Brooklyn and more widely. Thank you so much.
I want to add one quick thing that I didn't
Please
say
do.
That I'd be
okay.
guilty if I didn't say.
Okay.
So as we've talked about in our correspondence, we know that Freud knew about these things. If you look deeply into Totem and Taboo line by line,
yes.
you'll find his references to these concepts. So that's one thing that we know we have as a bridge, just as we have a bridge to Freud's work in India. The other is the word Ubuntu, which I think you've heard by now.
Yeah.
It's a Southern African word, and it is, I am not myself unless we are. That is an African concept. That is the concept that African theory has brought to all clinical work and is so often not identified and acknowledged. And I want to acknowledge those contributors, one of whom was the son of a medical doctor, son of a medical doctor, grandson of somebody who contributed to the now discredited work of Frazier, explaining these rituals so many years ago. And that as we think about our multicultural origins, and as we give them credit, we expand our possibilities. Thank you.
Beautiful.
For making
said.
It possible for me to do that today.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.